This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. We start today with a story from the October 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Boy Who Plaited Manes by Nancy Springer. The boy who plaited the manes of horses came, fittingly enough, on the day of the midsummer hunt, when he was needed worst, though Wald, the head groom, did not yet know it. The stable was in a muted frenzy of work, as it had been since long before dawn, every groom and apprentice vehemently polishing. The Lord's behest was that all the horses in his stable should be brushed for 2 hours every morning to keep the fine shine and bloom on their flanks, and this morning could be no different. Then there was also all the gear to be tended to. Though old Lord Robley of Auberon was a petty manor lord with only some hundreds of horses and less than half the number of grooms to show for a lifetime striving, his lowly status made him all the more keen to present himself and his retinue grandly before the more powerful lords who would assemble for the hunt, himself and his retinue and his lovely young wife. Therefore, it was an eerie thing when the boy walked up the long stable aisle past men possessed with work, men so frantic they took no notice at all of the stranger, up the aisle, brick-paved in chevron style, until he came to the stall where the lady's milk-white palfrey stood covered withers to croup with a fitted sheet tied on to keep the beast clean, and the boy swung open the heavy stall door and walked in without fear as if he belonged there, and went up to the palfrey to plait its mane. He was an eerie boy, so thin that he seemed deformed, of an age difficult to guess because of his thinness. He might have been 10, or he might have been 17, with something wrong about him that made him beardless and narrow-shouldered and thin. His eyes seemed too gathered for a 10-year-old, gray-green and calm, yet feral, like woodland. His hair, dark and shaggy, seemed to bulk large above his thin, thin face. The palfrey's hair was far better cared for than his. Its silky mane, coddled for length, hung down below its curved neck, and its tail was bundled into a wrapping to be let down at the last moment before the lady rose, when it would trail on the ground and float like a white bridal train. The boy did not yet touch the tail, but his thin fingers flew to work on the palfrey's mane. Wald, the head groom, passing nearly at a run to see to the saddling of the lord's hot-blooded hunter, stopped in his tracks and stared. And to be sure, it was not that he had never seen plaiting before. He himself had probably braided 1,000 horses' manes, and he knew what a time it took to put even a row of small looped braids along a horse's crest, and how hard it was to get them even, and how horsehair seems like a demon with a mind of its own. He frankly gawked, and other grooms stood beside him and did likewise, until more onlookers stood gathered outside the palfrey's stall than could rightly see, and those in the back demanded to know what was happening, and those in the front seemed not to hear them, but stood as if in a trance, watching the boy's thin, swift hands. For the boy's fingers moved more quickly and deftly than seemed human, than seemed possible, each hand by itself combing and plaiting a long, slender braid in one smooth movement, as if he no more than stroked the braid out of the mane. That itself would have been wonder enough, as when a groom is so apt that he can curry with one hand and follow after with the brush in the other, and have a horse done in half the time. A shining braid forming out of each hand every minute, wonder enough, but that was not the least of it. The boy interwove them as he worked, so that they flowed into each other in a network, making of the mane a delicate shawl, a veil that draped the palfrey's fine neck. The ends of the braids formed a silky hem, curving down to a point at the shoulder, and at the point the boy spiraled the remaining mane into an uncanny horsehair flower. And all the time, though it was not tied and was by no means a cold-blooded beast, the palfrey had not moved, standing still as stone. Then Wald, the head groom, felt fear prickling at the back of his astonishment. The boy had carried each plate down to the last three hairs, yet he had fastened nothing with thread or ribbon, but merely pressed the ends between two fingers, and the braids stayed as he had placed them. Nor did the braids ever seem to fall loose as he was working, or hairs fly out at random, but all lay smooth as white silk, shimmering. The boy, or whatever he was, stood still with his hands at his sides, admiring his work. Uncanny. Still, the lord and lady would be well pleased. Wald jerked himself out of amazement and moved quickly. "Get back to your work, you fellows," he roared at the grooms, and then he strode into the stall. "Who are you?" he demanded. "What do you mean, coming in here like this?" It was best in a lord's household never to let anyone know you were obliged to them. The boy looked at him silently, turning his head in the alert yet indifferent way of a cat. "I have asked you a question. What is your name?" The boy did not speak, or even move his lips. Then, or thereafter, as long as he worked in that stable, he never made any sound. His stolid manner annoyed Wald, but though the master groom could not yet know that the boy was a mute, he saw something odd in his face. A half-wit, perhaps. He wanted to strike the boy, but even worse, he wanted the praise of the lord and lady, so he turned abruptly and snatched the wrapping off the palfrey's tail, letting the cloud of white hair float to the clean straw of the stall. "Do something with that," he snapped. A sweet, intense glow came into the boy's eyes as he regarded his task. With his fingers, he combed the hair smooth, and then he started a row of small braids above the bone. Most of the tail he left loose and flowing, with just a cluster of braids at the top, a few of them swinging halfway to the ground. And young Lady Acklin gaped with pleasure when she saw them, and with wonder at the mane, even though she was a lord's daughter born and not unaccustomed to finery. It did not matter that day that Lord Robley's saddle had not been polished to a sufficient shine. He was well pleased with his grooms, nor did it matter that his hawks flew poorly, his hounds were unruly, and his clumsy hunter stumbled and cut its knees. Lords and ladies looked again and again at his young wife on her white palfrey, its tail trailing and shimmering like her blue silk gown, the delicate openwork of its mane as dainty as the lace kerchief tucked between her breasts, or her slender gloved hand that held the caparisoned reins. Every hair of her mount was as artfully placed as her own honey-gold hair, looped in gold beaded curls atop her fair young head. Lord Robley knew himself to be the envy of everyone who saw him for the sake of his lovely wife and the showing she made on her white mount with the plaited mane. And when the boy who plaited manes took his place among the lord's other servants in the kitchen line for the evening meal, no one gainsaid him. Lord Robley was a hard old man, his old body hard and hale, his spirit hard. It took him less than a day to pass from being well pleased to being greedy for more. No longer was it enough that the lady's palfrey should go forth in unadorned braids. He sent a servant to Wald with silk ribbons in the Oberon colors, dark blue and crimson, and commanded that they should be plaited into the palfrey's mane and tail. This the stranger boy did with ease when Wald ordered him to, and He used the ribbon ends to tie tiny bows and love knots and leave a few shimmering tendrils bobbing in the forelock. Lady Acklin was enchanted. Within a few days, Lord Robley had sent to the stable thread of silver and of gold, strings of small pearls, tassels, pendant jewels, and fresh-cut flowers of every sort. All of these things the boy who plaited manes used with ease to dress the lady's palfrey when he was bid. Lady Acklin went forth to the next hunt with tiny bells of silver and gold chiming at the tip of each of her mount's dainty ribbon-decked braids, and eyes turned her way wherever she rode. Nor did the boy ever seem to arrange the mane and tail and forelock twice in the same way, but whatever way he chose to plait and weave and dress it seemed the most perfect and poignant and heart-achingly beautiful way a horse had ever been arrayed. Once he did the palfrey's entire mane in one great thick braid along the crest, gathering in the hairs as he went, so that the neck seemed to arch as mightily as a destrier's, and he made the braid drip thick with flowers, roses and great lilies and spires of larkspur trailing down, so that the horse seemed to go with a mane of flowers. But another time he would leave the mane loose and floating, with just a few braids shimmering down behind the ears or in the forelock perhaps, and this also seemed perfect and poignant and the only way a horse should be adorned. Nor was it sufficient any longer that merely the lady's milk-white palfrey should go forth in braids. Lord Robley commanded that his hot-blooded hunter also should have his mane done up in stubby ribboned braids and rosettes in the Oberon colors, and the horses of his retinue likewise, though with lesser rosettes. And should his wife choose to go out riding with her noble guests, all their mounts were to be prepared like hers, though in lesser degree. All these orders Wald passed on to the boy who plaited manes, and the youngster really did as he was told, working sometimes from before dawn until long after dark, and never seeming to want more than what food he could eat while standing in the kitchen. He slept in the hay and straw of the loft, and did not use even a horse blanket for covering until one of the grooms threw one on him, nor did he ask for clothing. But Wald, ashamed of the boy's shabbiness, provided him with the clothing due to a servant. The master groom said nothing to him of a servant's pay. The boy seemed content without it. Probably he would have been content without the clothing as well, though in fact it was hard to tell what he was thinking or feeling, for he never spoke and his thin face seldom moved. No one knew his name, the boy who plaited manes, though many of the grooms were curious and made inquiries. No one could tell who he was or where he had come from, or even what he was. Wald thought sourly. No way to tell if the young snip was a half-wit or a bastard or what, if he would not talk. No way to tell what sort of a young warlock he might be, that the horses never moved under his hands, even the hot-blooded hunter standing like a stump for him. Scrawny brat! He could hear well enough. Why would he not talk? It did not make Wald like the strange boy that he did at once whatever he was told and worked so hard and so silently. In particular, he did not like the boy for doing the work for which Wald reaped the Lord's praise. Wald disliked anyone to whom he was obliged. Nor did he like the way the boy had arrived, as if blown in on a gust of wind and so thin that it nearly seemed possible. Nor did he like the thought that any day the boy might leave in like wise, and even disliking that thought, Wald could not bring himself to give the boy the few coppers a week which were his due, for he disliked the boy more. Wald believed there was something wrong-headed, nearly evil, about the boy. His face seemed wrong, so very thin, with the set mouth and the eyes both wild and quiet, burning like a steady candle flame. Summer turned into autumn, and many gusts of wind blew, but the boy who played at Maine seemed content to stay, and if he knew of Wald's dislike, he did not show it. In fact, he showed nothing. He braided the palfrey's mane with autumn star flowers and smiled ever so slightly as he worked. Autumn turned to the first dripping and dismal chill days of winter. The boy used bunches of bright feathers instead of flowers when he dressed the palfrey's mane, and he did not ask for a winter jerkin, so Wald did not give him any. It was seldom enough, anyway, that the horses were used for pleasure at this season. The thin boy could spend his days huddled under a horse blanket in the loft. Hard winter came, and the smallpox season. Lady Acklin was bored in the wintertime, even more so than during the rest of the year. At least in the fine weather, there were walks outside. There were riding and hunting and people to impress. It would not be reasonable for a lord's wife, nobly born, though a younger child and female, to wish for more than that. Lady Acklin knew full well that her brief days of friendships and courtships were over. She had wed tolerably well, and Lord Robley counted her among his possessions, a beautiful thing to be prized, like his gold and his best horses. He was a manor lord, and she was his belonging, his lady, and not for others to touch even with their regard. She was entirely his. So there were walks for her in walled gardens, and pleasure riding and hunting by her lord's side, and people to impress. But in the winter time, there were not even the walks. There was nothing for the Lady Acklin to do but tend to her needlework and her own beauty, endlessly concerned with her clothes, her hair, her skin, even though she was so young, no more than 17, for she knew in her heart that it was for her beauty that Lord Robley smiled on her, and for no other reason. And though she did not think it, she knew that her life lay in his grasping hands. Therefore, she was ardently uneasy and distressed only for herself when the woman who arranged her hair each morning was laid abed with smallpox. Though, as befits a lady of rank, Acklin hid her dismay in vexation, and it did not take her long to discover that none of her other tiring women could serve her nearly as well. "Mother of God!" she raged, surveying her hair in the mirror for perhaps the 10th time. "The groom who plaits the horses' manes in the stable could do better." Then the truth of her own words struck her, and desperation made her willing to dare. She smiled. "Bring him hither." Her women stammered and curtsied and fled to consult among themselves and exclaim with the help in the kitchen. After some few minutes of this, a bold kitchen maid was dispatched to the stable and returned with a shivering waif, the boy who plaited manes. It was not to be considered that such a beggar should go into the lady. Her tiring women squeaked in horror and made him bathe first in a wash basin before the kitchen hearth, for there was a strong smell of horse and stable about him. They ordered him to scrub his own hair with strong soap and scent himself with lavender, and while some of them giggled and fled, others giggled and stayed to pour water for him and see that he made a proper job of his ablutions. All that was demanded of him, the boy who plaited manes did without any change in his thin face, any movement of his closed mouth, any flash of his feral eyes. At last, they brought him clean clothing, jerkin, and woolen hose only a little too large, and pulled the things as straight as they could on him, and took him to the tower where the lady waited. He did not bow to the Lady Acklin, or look into her eyes for her instructions, but his still mouth softened a little, and his glance, calm and alert, like that of a woodland thing, darted to her hair, and at once, as if he could scarcely wait, he took his place behind her and lifted her tresses in his hands. Such a soft, fine, honey-colored mane of hair as he had never seen, and combs of gold and ivory lying at hand on a rosewood table, and ribbons of silk and gold, everything he could have wanted, his for the sake of his skill. He started at the forehead, and the lady sat as if in a trance beneath the deft touch of his hands. Gentle, he was so gentle, she had never felt such a soft and gentle touch from any man, least of all from her lord. When Lord Robley wanted to use one of his possessions, he seized it, not so hard as to hurt, but still firmly enough to take control. But this boy touched her as gently as a woman. No, a mother, for no tiring woman or maid had ever gentled her so. Yet, unmistakably, his was the touch of a man, though she could scarcely have told how she knew. Part of it was power. She could feel the gentle power in his touch. She could feel uncanny, altogether eerie and uncanny, what she was feeling. It was as if his quick fingers called to her hair in soft command, and her hair obeyed just for the sake of the one quick touch, all the while longing to embrace. She stayed breathlessly still for him, like the horses. He plaited her hair in braids thin as bluebell stems, only a wisp of hairs to each braid, one after another with both his left hands, as if each was as easy as a caress, making them stay with merely a touch of two fingers at the end, until all her hair lay in a silky cascade of them, catching the light and glimmering and swaying like a rich drapery when he made her move her head. Some of them he gathered and looped and tied up with the ribbons which matched her dress, blue, edged with gold, but most of them he left hanging to her bare back and shoulders. He surveyed his work with just a whisper of a smile when he was done, then turned and left without waiting for the lady's nod, and she sat as if under a spell and watched his thin back as he walked away. Then she tossed her head at his lack of courtesy, but the swinging of her hair pleased her. She had him back to dress her hair the next day, and the next, and many days thereafter, and so that they would not have to be always bathing him, her tiring women found him a room within the manor house doors, and a pallet and clean blankets and a change of clothing, plain, coarse clothing such as servants wore. They trimmed the heavy hair that shadowed his eyes also, but he looked no less the oddling with his thin, thin face and the calm, burning glance and his mouth that seemed scarcely ever to move. He did as he was bid, whether by Wald or the lady or some kitchen maid, and every day he plaited Lady Acklin's hair differently. One day he shaped it all into a bright crown of braids atop her head. On other days, he would plait it close to her head so that the tendrils caressed her neck, or in a haughty crest studded with jewels, or in a single soft feathered braid at one side. He always left her tower chamber at once, never looking at the lady to see if he had pleased her, as if he knew that she would always be pleased. Always she was. Things happened. The tiring woman who had taken smallpox died of it, and Lady Acklin did not care, not for the sake of her cherished hair, and most certainly not for the sake of the woman herself. Lord Robley went away on a journey to discipline a debtor vassal, and Lady Ackland did not care except to be glad, for there was a sure sense growing in her of what she would do. When even her very tresses were enthralled by the touch of this oddling boy, longing to embrace him, could she be otherwise? When next he had plaited her mane of honey-colored hair and turned to leave without a glance, she caught him by one thin arm. His eyes met hers with a steady, gathered look. She stood. She was taller than he and larger, though she was as slender as any maiden. It did not matter. She took him by one thin hand and led him to her bed, and there he did as he was bid. Nor did he disappoint her. His touch, she had never been touched so softly, so gently, so deftly, with such power. Nor was he lacking in manhood, for all that he was as thin and hairless as a boy. And his lips, after all, knew how to move, and his tongue. But it was the touch of his thin hands that she hungered for, the gentle, tender, potent touch that thrilled her almost as if she were loved. He smiled at her afterwards, slightly, softly, a whisper of a smile in the muted half-light of her curtained bed, and his lips moved. "You are swine," he said, "all of you nobles." And he got up, put on his plain, coarse clothing, and left her without a backwards glance. It terrified Lady Ackland that he was not truly a mute, terrified her even more than what he had said, though she burned with mortified wrath whenever she thought of the latter. He, of all people, a mute, to speak such words to her and leave her helpless to avenge herself. Perhaps for that reason he would not betray her. She had thought it would be safe to take a mute as her lover. Perhaps he would not betray her. In fact, it was not he who betrayed her to his lord, but Wald. Her tiring woman suspected, perhaps because she had sent them on such a long errand. She had not thought they would suspect. Who would think that such a wisp of a beardless boy could be a bedfellow? But perhaps they also had seen the wild glow deep in his gray-green eyes. They whispered among themselves, and with the kitchen maids, and the bold kitchen maid giggled with the grooms, and Wald heard. Even though the boy who plaited manes did it all, Wald considered the constant plaiting and adorning of manes and tails a great bother. The whole fussy business offended him, he had decided, and he had long since forgotten the few words of praise it had garnered from the lord at first. Moreover, he disliked the boy so vehemently that he was not thinking clearly. It seemed to him that he could be rid of the boy and the wretched onus of braids and rosettes all in one stroke. The day the lord returned from his journey, Wald hurried to him, begged private audience, bowed low, and made his humble report. Lord Robley heard him in icy silence, for he knew pettiness when he saw it. It had served him often in the past, and he would punish it if it misled him. He summoned his wife to question her, but the Lady Ackland's hair hung lank, and her guilt and shame could be seen plainly in her face from the moment she came before him. Lord Robley's roar could be heard even to the stables. He strode over to her, where she lay crumpled and weeping on his chamber floor, lifted her head by its honey gold hair, and slashed her across the face with his sword. Then he left her screaming and stinging her wound with fresh tears, and he strode to the stable with his bloody sword still drawn, Wald fleeing before him all the way. When the lord burst in, all the grooms were scattered but one. The boy, Wald had accused, stood plaiting the white palfrey's mane. Lord Robley hacked the palfrey's head from its braid-bedecked neck with his sword, and the boy who played it mane stood by with something smoldering deep in his unblinking gray-green eyes. He stood calmly, waiting. If he had screamed and turned to flee, Lord Robley would, with great satisfaction, have given him a coward's death from the back. But it unnerved the Lord that the boy awaited his pleasure with such mute, what, defiance? There was no servant's boy in this one, no falling in the oiled straw, no groveling. If he had groveled, he could have been kicked, stabbed, killed out of hand also. But this silent, watchful waiting, like the alertness of a wild thing on the hunt or being hunted, it gave Lord Robley pause, like the pause of the wolf before the standing stag, or the pause of the huntsman before the thicketed boar. He held the boy at the point of his sword, though no such holding was necessary, for the prisoner had not moved even to tremble, and roared for his men-at-arms to take the boy to the dungeon. There, the nameless stranger stayed without water or food, and aside from starving him, Lord Robley could not decide what to do with him. At first, the boy who plaited manes paced in his prison restlessly. He had that freedom, for he was so thin and small that the shackles were too large to hold him. Later, he lay in a scant bed of short straw and stared narrow-eyed at the darkness. And yet later, seeing the thin cascades of moonlight flow down through the high iron-barred window and puddle in moon glades on the stone floor, he got up and began to plait the moonbeams. They were far finer than any horsehair moonbeams, finer even than the lady's honey-colored locks, and his eyes grew wide with wonder and pleasure as he felt them. He made them into braids as fine as silk threads, flowing together into a lacework as close as woven cloth, and when he had reached as high as he could plaiting, he stroked as if combing a long mane with his fingers and pulled more moonlight down out of the sky, for this stuff was not like any other stuff he had ever worked with. It slipped and slid worse than any hair. There seemed to be no beginning or end to it, except the barriers that men put in its way. He stood plaiting the fine, thin plates until he had raised a shimmering heap on the floor, and then he stepped back and allowed the moon to move on. His handiwork he laid carefully aside in a corner. The boy, who plaited moonbeams, did not sleep, but sat watching for the dawn, his eyes glowing greenly in the darkened cell. He saw the sky lighten beyond the high window and waited stolidly as the wolf waits for the gathering of the pack, as a wild cat waits for the game to pass along the trail below the rock where it lies. Not until the day had neared its mid did the sun's rays thrust through the narrow space between the high bars, wheel their shafts down to where he could reach them. Then he got up and began to plait the sunlight. Guards were about, or more alert, in the daytime, and they gathered at the heavy door of his prison, peering in between the iron bars of its small window, gawking and quarreling with each other for turns. They watched his unwavering eyes, saw the slight smile come on his face as he worked, though his thin hands glowed red as if seen through fire. They saw the shining around as he raised on the floor and whispered among themselves and did not know what to do, for none of them dared to touch it or him. One of them requested a captain to come look, and the captain summoned the steward, and the steward went to report to the Lord, and from outside the cries began to sound that the sun was standing still. After the boy had finished, he stood back and let the sun move on, then sat resting on his filthy straw. Within minutes, The dungeon door burst open, and Lord Rogley himself strode in. Lord Rogley had grown weary of mutilating his wife, and he had not yet decided what to do with his other prisoner. Annoyed by the reports from the prison, he expected that an idea would come to him when he saw the boy. He entered with drawn sword, but all thoughts of the thin young body before him were sent whirling away from his mind by what he saw laid out on the stone floor at his feet. A mantle, a kingly cloak, but no king had ever owned such a cloak, all shining, the outside of it silver and the inside gold. But no, to call it silver and gold was to insult it, more like water and fire, flow and flame, shimmering as if it moved, as if it were alive, and yet it had been made by hands. He could see the workmanship so fine that every thread was worth a gasp of pleasure, the outside of it somehow braided and plaited to the lining, and all around the edge a fringe of threads like bright fur, so fine that it wavered in the air like flame. Lord Rogley had no thought but to steadle the fiery, gleaming thing on his shoulders, to wear that glory and be finer than any king. He seized it and flung it on, and screamed, as he had not yet made his wife scream, with the shriek of mortal agony. His whole hard body glowed as if it had been placed in a furnace. His face contorted, and he fell dead. The boy, who plaited sunbeams, got up in a quiet, alert way and walked forward as noiselessly on his feet as a lynx. He reached down and took the cloak off the body of the Lord, twirled it and placed it on his own shoulders, and it did not harm him. But in that cloak he seemed insubstantial, like something moving in moonlight and shadow, something nameless roaming in the night. He walked out of the open dungeon door, between the guards clustered there, past the Lord's retinue and the steward, and they all shrank back from him, flattened themselves against the stone walls of the corridor so as not to come near him. No one dared take hold of him or try to stop him. He walked out through the courtyard, past the stable, and out the manor gates with the settled air of one whose business is done. The men-at-arms gathered atop the wall and watched him go. Wald, the master groom, lived to an old age, sweating every night with terror, and died of a weakened heart in the midst of a nightmare. Nothing else but his own fear harmed him. The boy who plaited, mane of sun, mane of moon, was never seen again in that place, except that children sometimes told the tale of having glimpsed him in the wild heart of a storm, plaiting the long lashes of wind and rain. We conclude with a story from the July 1986 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Stalking the Unicorn with Gun and Camera by Mike Resnick. When she got to within 200 yards of the herd of southern savannah unicorns she had been tracking for 4 days, Rila of the Seven Stars made her obeisance to Qatar Main, god of the hunt, then donned the amulet of Kobasan, tested the breeze to make sure that she was still downward of the herd, and began approaching them, camera in hand. But Rila of the Seven Stars had made one mistake, a mistake of carelessness, and 30 seconds later she was dead, brutally impaled upon the horn of a bull unicorn. Hotak, the beast slayer, cautiously made his way up the lower slopes of the mountain of the Nameless One. He was a skilled tracker, a fearless hunter, and a crack shot. He picked out the trophy he wanted, got the beast within his sights, and hurled his killing club, It flew straight and true to its mark. And yet, less than a minute later, Hotrak, his left leg badly gored, was barely able to pull himself to safety in the branches of a nearby rainbow tree. He, too, had made a mistake of ignorance. Bort, the pure, had had a successful safari. He had taken 3 chimeras, a gorgon, and a beautifully matched pair of griffins. While his trolls were skinning the gorgon, he spotted a unicorn sporting a near-record horn, and weapon in hand, he began pursuing it. The terrain gradually changed, and suddenly, Bort found himself in a shoulder-high kraken grass. Undaunted, he followed the trail into the dense vegetation. But Bort the Pure, too, had made a mistake of foolishness. His trolls found very little remained of him some 6 hours later. Carelessness, ignorance, foolishness, together they account for more deaths among unicorn hunters than all other factors combined. Take our examples, for instance. All 3 hunters, Riela, Hotak, and Bort, were experienced safari hands. They were used to extremes of temperature and terrain. They didn't object to finding insects in their ale or banshees in their tents. They knew they were going after deadly game and took all reasonable precautions before setting out. And yet, 2 of them died, and the 3rd was badly maimed. Let's examine their mistakes and see what we can learn from them. Rena, of the 7 stars, assimilated everything her personal wizard could tell her about unicorns, purchased the very finest photographic equipment, hired a native guide who had been on many unicorn hunts, and had a local witch doctor bless her amulet of Cobasin. And yet, when the charge came, the amulet was of no use to her, for she had failed to properly identify the particular subspecies of unicorn before her. And as I am continually pointing out during my lecture tours, the amulet of Cohasin is potent only against the rare and almost extinct forest unicorns. Against the southern savanna unicorn, the only effective charm is the talisman of Triskonis, carelessness. Hotak, the beast slayer, on the other hand, disdained all forms of supernatural protection. To him, the essence of the hunt was to pit himself in physical combat against his chosen prey. His killing club, a beautifully wrought and finely balanced instrument of destruction, had brought down simurgs, humbabas, and even a dreaded woolly hydra. He elected to go for a headshot, and the club flew to within a millimeter of where he had aimed it, but he hadn't counted on the unicorn's phenomenal sense of smell, nor the speed with which these surly brutes can move. Alerted to Hotak's presence, the unicorn turned its head to seek out its predator, and the killing club bounced harmlessly off its horn. Had Hotak spoken to almost any old-time unicorn hunter, he would have realized that headshots are almost impossible and would have gone for a crippling knee shot. Ignorance. Bort the Pure was aware of the unique advantages accruing to a virgin who hunts the wild unicorn, and so had practiced sexual abstinence since he was old enough to know what the term meant. And yet, he naively believed that because his virginity allowed him to approach the unicorn more easily than other huntees, the unicorn would somehow become placid and make no attempt to defend itself. And so he followed a vicious animal that was compelled to let him approach it and entered a patch of high grass that allowed him no maneuvering room during the inevitable charge. foolishness. Every year, hundreds of hopeful hunters go out in search of the unicorn, and every year, all but a handful come back empty-handed, if they come back at all. And yet, the unicorn can be safely stalked and successfully hunted if only the stalkers and hunters will take the time to study their quarry. When all is said and done, the unicorn is a relatively docile beast, except when enraged. It is a creature of habit, and once those habits have been learned by the hopeful photographer or trophy hunter, bringing home that picture or that horn is really no more dangerous than, say, slaying an eight-forked dragon, and it's certainly easier than lassoing wild minotaurs, a sport that has become all the rage these days among the smart set on the Platinum Range. However, before you can photograph or kill a unicorn, you have to find it, and by far, the easiest way to find it is to follow the families of smurfs that track the great game migrations. The smurfs, of course, have no natural enemies except for the Rapsheen and the Zumakin, and consequently will allow a human or preternatural being to approach them quite closely. A word of warning about the smurf. With its long ears and cute fuzzy body, it resembles nothing more than an oversized rabbit. But calling a smurf a rabbit doesn't make it one, and you would be ill-advised to underestimate the strength of those nasty little scavengers. Although they generally hunt in packs of from 10 to 20, I have more than once seen a single smurf, its aura flowing with savage strength, pull down a half-grown unicorn. Smurfs are poor eating. Their pelts are worth less because of the difficulty of curing and tanning the auras, and they make pretty unimpressive trophies unless you can come up with one possessing a truly magnificent set of ears. In fact, in many areas, they're still classified as vermin, but the wise unicorn hunter can save himself a lot of time and effort by simply letting the smurfs lead him to his prey. With the onset of poaching, the legendary unicorn herds, numbering upwards of 1,000 members, no longer exist, and you'll find that the typical herd today consists of from 50 to 75 individuals. The days when a photographer, safe and secure in a blind by a waterhole, could preserve on film an endless stream of the brutes coming down to drink are gone forever. And it is absolutely shocking to contemplate the number of unicorns that have died simply so their horns could be sold on the black market. In fact, I find it appalling that anyone in this enlightened day and age still believes that a powdered unicorn horn can act as an aphrodisiac. Indeed, as any magus can tell you, you treat the unicorn horn with essence of gratch and then boil it slowly in a solution of sphinx blood. Now that's an aphrodisiac. But I digress. The unicorn, being a non-discriminating browser that is equally content to feed upon grasses, leaves, fruits, and an occasional fern tree, occurs in a wide variety of habitats, often in the company of grazers such as centaurs and the Pegasus. Once you have spotted the unicorn herd, it must be approached with great care and caution. The unicorn may have poor eyesight, and its sense of hearing may not be much better, but it has an excellent sense of smell and an absolutely awesome sense of grimsch, about which so much has been written that there is no point in my belaboring the subject yet again. If you're on a camera safari, I would strongly advise against trying to get closer than 100 yards or even a solitary beast, that sense of grimsh again. And most of the photographers I know swear by an 85 350 millimeter automatic focus zoom lens, providing, of course, that it has been blessed by a warlock of the third order. If you haven't got the shots you want by sunset, my best advice is to pack it in for the day and return the next morning. Flash photography is possible, of course, but it does tend to attract Gollum and other even more bothersome nocturnal predators. One final note to the camera buff. For reasons our alchemists have not yet determined, no unicorn has ever been photographed with normal emulsified film of any speed, so make absolutely sure that you use one of the more popular infrared brands. It would be a shame to spend weeks on safari, paying for your guide, cook, and trolls, only to come away with a series of photos of the forest that you thought was merely the background to your pictures. As for hunting the brutes, the main thing to remember is that they are as close to you as you are to them. For this reason, while I don't disdain blood sacrifices, amulets, talismans, and blessings, all of which have their proper place, I, for one, always feel more confident with a 550 Nitro Express in my hands. A little extra stopping power can give a hunter quite a feeling of security. You'll want a bull unicorn, of course. They tend to have more spectacular horns than cows, and by the time a bull's horn is long enough to be worth taking, he's probably too old to be in the herd's breeding program anyway. The headshot, for reasons explained earlier, is never a wise option, and unless your wizard teaches you the rune of Mamhotep, thus enabling you to approach close enough to pour salt on the beast's tail and thereby put him to the spot where he's standing, I recommend the heart shot. Either heart will do, and if you have a double-barreled gun, you might try to hit both of them just to be on the safe side. If you have the bad fortune to merely wound the beast, he'll immediately make off through the trees or the high grass, which puts you at an enormous disadvantage. Some hunters, faced with such a situation, merely stand back and allow the smurfs to finish the job for them. After all, smurfs rarely devour the horn unless they're completely famished, but this is hardly sporting. The decent, honorable hunter, well aware of the unwritten rules of blood sports, will go after the unicorn himself. The trick, of course, is to meet him on fairly open terrain. Once the unicorn lowers his head to charge, he's virtually blind, and all you need to do is dance nimbly out of his way and take another shot at him. Or, if you are not in possession of the rune of Mamhotep, this would be an ideal time to get out that salt and try to sprinkle some on his tail as he races by. When the unicorn dictates the rules of the game, you've got a much more serious situation. He'll usually double back and lie in the tall grasses beside his spore, waiting for you to pass by, and then attempt to gore you from behind. It is at this time that the hunter must have all his wits about him. Probably the best sign to look for is the presence of fire-breathing dragonflies. These noxious little insects frequently live in symbiosis with the unicorn, cleansing his ears of parasites, and their presence usually means that the unicorn isn't far off. Yet another sign that your prey is nearby will be the flocks of hungry harpies circling overhead, waiting to sweep down and feed upon the remains of your kill. And, of course, the surest sign of off is when you hear a grunt of rage and find yourself staring into the bloodshot, beady little eyes of a wounded bull unicorn from a distance of 10 feet or less. It's moments like that that make you feel truly alive, especially when you suddenly realize that this isn't necessarily a permanent condition. All right, let us assume that your hunt is successful. What then? Well, your trolls will skin the beast, of course, and take special care in removing and preserving the horn. If they've been properly trained, they'll also turn the pelt into a rug, the hooves into ashtrays, the teeth into a necklace and tail into a fly swatter, and the scrotum into a tobacco pouch. My own feeling is that you should settle for nothing less, since it goes a long way towards showing the bleeding heart preservationists that a unicorn can supply the hunter with a lot more than just a few minutes of pleasurable sport and a horn. And while I'm on the subject of what the unicorn can supply, let me strongly suggest that you would be missing a truly memorable experience if you were to come home from safari without having eaten unicorn meat at least once. There's nothing quite like unicorn cooked over an open campfire to top off a successful hunt. And do remember to leave something out for the smurfs, or they might well decide that hunter is every bit as tasty as unicorn. So get out those amulets and talismans, visit those wizards and warlocks, pack those cameras and weapons, and good hunting to you. This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction.